This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll discuss the latest efforts to solve the teacher shortage in Illinois and how technology has changed how students learn about college acceptance or rejection. Also, how can we measure success of college in-prison programs? This week marked the anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's assassination. A researcher has uncovered more on how the news was received.
I expected to find that the major responses would be shock and grief, and they were. What I also found in the North was that Lincoln's opponents, so-called copperheads, were celebrating the assassination in some of the same ways the Confederates were celebrating the assassination.
And we'll hear why some don't buy the argument that legalizing recreational marijuana will improve social justice. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, legalizing recreational marijuana use. A lot of people say the effort is about social justice, but not everyone believes people of color will benefit. We'll also look back at the assassination of Abraham Lincoln and how the news was received across the country, and how research is showing some better ways to lose weight. That and more this hour on Statewide. Imagine sitting in class in high school and finding out in an email that your dream college has made a decision about your application. That's how many of today's seniors are learning about their futures. Kate McGee reports on how social media has amped up pressure on students as they make a big life decision.
Nick Joy has a routine when he opens his emails these days.
I close my eyes before and then I open my eyes. And just in case, like, there's like, an email from a college, and I'm like, oh, my God, is this it?
Joy is telling this to his fellow seniors at the Chicago High School for the Arts. They're sitting in a circle, checking in with each other about college. They're starting to hear back from schools, and there was a lot of uncertainty, says senior Stephanie Galicia.
There's this whole pressure of, like, you need to have everything figured out right now, and if you don't, well, then you're not going to succeed.
That pressure is felt by students and parents alike, as made clear by the recent college admissions scandal where parents bribed and cheated to get their children into top schools. And it's a pressure that's existed for decades. But social media and technology have changed the way students hear from schools and share news with friends. Nick Joy says everything about this process is now publicized.
And everything is, like, you know, on Instagram. Like, I scroll through my feed and I see people posting pictures of screenshots of their acceptances, and I'm like, oh my God, like, it's overwhelming.
Let's start with how schools send decisions. Now it's mostly via email. Joy even got alerted he was accepted to a school via text message. This means decisions land in students' inboxes at all hours, including during the school day or out with their friends, rather than at home. Whitney Young senior Joe Radinsky found out he wasn't accepted early to the University of Chicago right after school, standing on an L-train platform. He'd been waiting all day for that email, and it was a blow to his ego.
Like, I sort of deflated, and sort of for the next 2 days, I was like, what did I do wrong? Like, what about me isn't enough?
Some students tried to avoid opening these emails in public, waiting to get home. That didn't work for Keith Calloway. When Yale released their college decisions, the school sent a tweet saying decisions were out. He tried to wait until he got home.
But then 3 minutes later, I was like, okay, they're out. I can't take this. I have to know. And I logged in and I saw that I got in. I was like, oh my gosh, like, I have to go.
He left class and called his family. But news travels fast.
As I was walking out, I saw some of my friends, and actually some of them overheard me on the phone. And by the time I hung up the phone, they had already, like, sent it to other people that, like, I had gotten into Yale.
That's another change. Everyone is sharing the news on social media as it happens. Senior Joe Radinsky says it took some time to adjust to all the college news on his social media channels. It was hard not to take the updates personally.
And so when I see people like posting about other people's acceptances, like normally I do have a gut reaction, and I'm not like super proud to say this, I just like, yikes, like what did I do? Like what did I do wrong?
Some students post updates like 10 out of 10, that means they got into everywhere they applied. Others only share their acceptances on private Snapchat channels or Finstas, fake Instagram. Usually that's a student's more private Instagram account, only to be shared with close friends. That's how Radinsky found out some friends were also deferred from the University of Chicago. They shared it privately. It made him feel a little better. It was nice to have friends going through the same thing. Now when he sees people post college news on social media, he has a different reaction.
I've been able to like grow from my first like, what is this, like reaction to like, yes, like good for you. Like that's amazing.
Researchers say it's important to remember not all students use or are affected by social media in the same way, and adults should do more listening to figure out how to support them effectively, and kids should take more time to process before sharing. Kate McGee, WBEZ News.
This week marked the 154th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's assassination. We've all heard how the U.S. was sent into a period of shock and grief when word of Lincoln's murder spread. Newspapers reported it that way. But what about the average American, North or South, white or black? Martha Hodes set out to learn more from their letters and personal notations. The NYU professor wrote a book on the subject. It's called Mourning Lincoln, and it brings their intimate thoughts to light in the months after Lincoln died. And I talked with her about the project.
Well, lots of people have written about Lincoln's assassination, but most scholars and writers who've written about Lincoln have written about public responses. So they've used newspaper articles or sermons or public expressions of condolence, and all of those are important points. But nobody had thought to read through the hundreds and hundreds of letters and diaries and other personal writings that were created in the immediate aftermath of the assassination, so literally in the hours, days, and weeks following Lincoln's assassination. So by reading through these sources, and I did read through hundreds and hundreds of such sources, of course there are many I didn't get to, but by reading through those sources, we get a different vision. We get a vision of a nation that is not united in mourning, which is something that many of the public sources claim. We get a vision of a nation quite divided right at the end of a civil war that terribly divided the nation. So that's what was so interesting to me. The personal responses illuminate a key moment of confusion and conflict that's been left out of the story.
Certainly, people in the South may have taken quite often a different view of Lincoln when he was alive and even in death. Is it your take that maybe people might have felt differently about his assassination had it not been so close to the end, the defeat of the Confederacy?
For Confederates, the trauma of the moment was less Lincoln's assassination than the fact that they had just lost this terrible four-year bloody war. And you can see that in personal writings of Confederates, because at times they will make a notation of the assassination but spend most of their time lamenting the defeat. Now, when Confederates thought about Lincoln and Lincoln's assassination, two things happened. First, Confederates did despise Lincoln, and that was because of the Civil War, and of course his election is what prompted secession. But the other point that's so interesting is at the same time the Confederates are celebrating Lincoln's assassination, because it's almost like a moment of reprieve for them from the horror of defeat, they're also worried because they have this sense that Lincoln would have been good to them had he lived, whether or not that's true. So while the freed people are calling Lincoln their best friend after his assassination, so are white Southerners calling Lincoln their best friend right after assassination. By the way, that wasn't something that developed later over the years and decades of the Lost Cause. It was something I found on the day Lincoln died in white Southern writings.
And there has always been that theory that Reconstruction might have gone differently had Lincoln lived. People were worried, you know, what happens to me? What happens to the South? What happens to the way of life that I've known? And especially with somebody unknown taking the White House.
Think at first, or I should really say white Northerners and white Southerners think at first that Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, the vice president, is going to be tougher on former slaveholders and the Confederates because Johnson is known to have hated the Southern aristocracy. African Americans, however, have a sense right from the start that this is not going to be the case. And African Americans know this, and I realize this through reading letters in black newspapers and Frederick Douglass and other kinds of black voices. Johnson's roots are as a poor white Southerner, And they make the point, African-American mourners make the point, that Johnson hates black people more than he hates the Southern aristocracy. And that's, of course, what turns out to be true in Reconstruction. Johnson essentially sides with the Confederates and dismisses African-Americans. And I have many petitions and letters that African-American mourners wrote to Johnson saying things like, think about what your noble predecessor would have done, you know, were he alive. And Johnson does not follow through on the policies of black, not just black freedom. I mean, freedom has been gained, but equality, citizenship, land, education. So we do not know, we cannot know what would have happened had Lincoln lived. But there is a sense, and Frederick Douglass makes this point, that he would have listened to black petitioners. He would have listened to African Americans, the freed people, black politicians, black leaders, in a way that Johnson did not. Johnson dismissed those people out of hand when the war was over and he took the presidency.
For African Americans, without Lincoln there, many of them felt as though that the rug would be pulled back out from under them, correct?
Absolutely. Of course, African Americans had been critical of Lincoln during the war. They thought that he was too slow to act upon emancipation. By the time the war was over, Lincoln had been influenced greatly by African Americans and by white abolitionists as well. And of course, there was the Emancipation Proclamation by then. There was the second inaugural address by then in which Lincoln made clear that slavery was the cause of the war and God would not let the war end until slavery was over. And then there was the last speech that Lincoln made. Of course, no one knew it would be his last speech when he stood on the White House balcony on April 11th, in which he hinted at his preference for suffrage for certain groups of black men. So once Lincoln was assassinated, African Americans, you're absolutely right, were devastated and proceeded to invoke Lincoln as a model of a radicalism that he may or may not have lived up to had he lived. But the fear among African Americans was very great. And white mourners conceded that the loss was greater for African Americans than for themselves. In their diaries and letters, they would make that point.
We're talking with Professor Martha Hodes. She's the author of Mourning Lincoln. You feel as though that the public may be a little misinformed when it comes to Reconstruction and how that was handled because of Lincoln's death?
Yes. So there is a misconception that because Lincoln was assassinated, the North was harsher on the vanquished Confederacy. What I found in reading through all of these sources was that people understood, Lincoln's mourners understood the assassination as a message from God indicating that God had to take Lincoln away because otherwise the Confederates would not be treated with the kind of harshness they needed to be treated, with in order to make the nation move forward. So instead of avenging Lincoln's assassination, the Union wanted to avenge war, secession and war, and also slavery, because people were very clear, mourners were very clear, not only abolitionists, that Lincoln was assassinated because of slavery. That was what was to blame. Of course, Booth was to blame and Confederate leaders were to blame, but slavery was the cause of the assassination. And people made that comment even before they went to church on Easter Sunday, and ministers made that comment. So the treatment of the Confederates during Reconstruction was a result of everything that had led up to Reconstruction without the assassination making it any worse. That's not what people were avenging. And I think it's very important to understand that people took this, Lincoln's mourners took this as a message from God to move the nation, especially in the view of black and white radicals, giving African Americans the vote, education, land, citizenship, equality, freedom.
And we talked about the South, but what about the North? What we've always heard, as you'd mentioned earlier, was that newspaper accounts were that the North was in a terrible mourning after the assassination. Is that what you found in these personal writings?
Well, yes, in many ways. I thought, I expected to find that the major responses would be shock and grief, and they were. So people were utterly astounded, stupefied. They couldn't believe it was real. They were overcome with gloom and grief. Men were weeping in the streets. All of that was true. What I also found in the North was that Lincoln's opponents, the so-called Copperheads, were celebrating the assassination in some of the same ways that Confederates were celebrating the assassination. So they were reveling, they were laughing and clapping and cheering in the streets. Of course, some people stayed out of sight for fear, and the ones who did demonstrate that kind of glee were threatened and sometimes visited with violence. They made jokes about Lincoln. Just to give one example, one man made the comment that he has as much of a brain now as he ever had, which was a reference to John Wilkes Booth shooting him in the head. Union soldiers and sailors who were copperheads said terrible things about Lincoln and were visited by the wrath of their comrades. So not even the North was wholly unified. And what's so interesting is that Lincoln's mourners will say in one sentence, the whole world is mourning. And then in the next sentence in a diary or letter will describe some of the people in their town who are not mourning Lincoln, but who are reacting with glee. So they know it's not true, but it's a kind of comforting trope that the whole world is mourning for Lincoln.
Many of us, if we didn't live through it, certainly have seen many times the assassination of John F. Kennedy on television and the film that has become so famous of that. We didn't have that film of Lincoln. Do you think those two incidents were treated differently because of the lack of the visual imagery, or could you tell that from what you were reading?
When Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, people got the news from television or radio, and then television was the key way of making this real, that this had really happened. If you didn't have a television at home in 1963, you stood out on the sidewalk in front of an appliance store watching television in the window. In a crowd of people. Today, if there was a catastrophe, people would turn to their cell phones and social media. When Lincoln was assassinated, people would get the news from a telegram or the newspaper, sometimes the morning it happened if the telegraph lines were connected. And then it seemed so unbelievable that the first thing people did in 1865 was leave the house and verify that this had happened by looking into one another's faces. So over and over again in diaries and letters, I would find descriptions of people saying, I immediately got up from the breakfast table. I got dressed. I went outside. I looked into the stricken faces around me. I saw expressions of horror and grief. I saw tears rolling down people's cheeks. People knocked on doors. They rapped on windows. They told other people. The way to see that this had really happened was to verify human expressions. So sometimes I like to say not Facebook, but human faces in 1865. That was essential to understanding that this event had really come to pass.
Martha Hodes is author of a book called Mourning Lincoln, looking at reaction to the death of Abraham Lincoln. The 16th president died 154 years ago this week after being shot at Ford's Theater in Washington. Up next, why some are challenging the idea that legalization of recreational marijuana will help communities of color. Stay with us for more of Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, leaders of a college in-prison program in central Illinois say whether someone returns to prison after taking classes is not a good way to measure the program's success.
You can't measure how many people's lives I've saved, right? Because if my goal is to stop retaliatory violence, how do you measure that?
The college in-prison program is trying to measure its value beyond recidivism rates. We'll have more in a story just ahead. Politicians spearheading the effort to legalize recreational marijuana say revenue is not the driving force. They say it's about promoting criminal and social justice for people of color who've been unfairly targeted by the war on drugs. But prominent activists from minority communities are questioning if these lofty goals are actually possible. And Jacqueline Driscoll has our Illinois Issues report.
We've heard it from the sponsors.
Step one is ending prohibition. Undoing the harm of the war on drugs.
We've heard it from our governor.
I think we should take this action for our state because of the beneficial criminal and social justice implications and the jobs that it will create.
Justice, say State Representative Kelly Cassidy and Governor J.B. Pritzker, is the most important part of legalization. But not everybody is buying it.
But we hear the people in power, they're saying, the biggest issue for us is social justice. Do you just not believe them?
No, I don't believe them.
That's Teresa Haley. She's the president of the Springfield chapter of the NAACP. Her group opposes legalization efforts, although she supports expunging records and releasing people from jail or prison for minor pot crimes. But Haley worries about what comes after that.
Where do they go?
They don't have jobs. They don't have training programs. They don't have housing. So if you release them without programs and without the assistance that they need to be successful, you're setting them up for failure and to return back to the prison system.
To be fair, Illinois decriminalized the drug back in 2016. And even before that, not many people were prosecuted for only a small marijuana offense. According to the Center for Criminal Justice Reform, if Illinois did let people out of prison for these offenses, they could probably all fit into the same bus. As of June 2018, of the more than 40,000 inmates in prison, only 42 were serving sentences for felony cannabis possession. Still, Haley's larger point is Black and brown communities that have already been disproportionately harmed by the war on drugs will continue to suffer. Robert Moore, who is a retired chief of police and federal marshal, sides with Haley. He says legalization will allow law enforcement to continue to target minority communities.
As a police officer, I know that you're probably going to be carrying more than what you legally do. I can say that that's more than 3 ounces that you got. And so you got to prove maybe that's true.
Since decriminalization, police departments aren't required to report misdemeanor arrests or tickets, so statewide data is scarce. But last summer, the Chicago Sun-Times found that of the 94 people that were busted for pot possession in the city, 76 of them were Black, 16 were Hispanic, and 2 were white. That's despite evidence that usage rates among races are primarily the same. Nationally, according to the ACLU, Blacks have been 4 times more likely to be arrested than whites for marijuana possession. And in Illinois, Blacks are up to 8.5 times more likely to be arrested. Moore believes this problem will persist.
These stops are going to happen. They're going to happen. It just can't be eliminated at this point with this free flow of drugs.
Ed Wojcicki, director of the Illinois Chiefs of Police, doesn't necessarily believe this, but says the conversation is important.
I think most law enforcement people would say we don't deliberately go out and adversely affect any Black or brown community. And I believe that that's true, but then I'd listen to others who would disagree.
Still, stakeholders say this restorative justice is the most important part of legalization. But right now, actual details of what that means or what it will look like are scant. Like the rest of the legislation, Representative Kelly Cassidy, a lead sponsor, says it's all an ongoing conversation.
We have to restore people's records. We have to make sure that that the damage done by the war on drugs, whether that's to individuals, to families, or communities, or neighborhoods, that has to be a priority in this model to make sure we get it right.
Without those details, though, some advocates for minority communities just aren't convinced.
I don't see this as being social justice. I see this as being social injustice because poor people will continue to be poor and be even poorer while the rich get richer.
Which leads us to another important piece, the economics. Who will own and profit from these businesses? That's next week. I'm Jacqueline Driscoll.
Doctors often advise patients to lose weight, but that's easier said than done. Steph Whiteside finds out about some new research techniques that can help.
If you've been trying to drop the pounds and are struggling, it's not just an issue of willpower.
And then your brain is fighting you on multiple fronts.
Dr. Megha Manick is a physician at the Southern Illinois University School of Medicine, where she works with patients who are trying to lose weight. Patients like Kathy Duxa, who lost 50 pounds working with a wellness program at the school.
I was 57 years old, and I could see that my weight was going to kill me faster than it was going to keep me alive. And I had a brief epiphany that, gee, now's the time. Or it's either now or a piano box.
Dr. Manick says losing weight is important for many patients.
Based on statistics from the World Health Organization released in January 2019, obesity has reached an epidemic proportions globally. We are estimating 2.8 million people dying each year as a result of being overweight or obese.
In Illinois, 31% of adults are considered obese. That puts them at risk for health conditions like heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and certain types of cancer. But even when it's important, losing weight can be a difficult goal to achieve. That's thanks in part to your brain. Dr. Mehul Trivedi studies neuroscience and behavior at the SIU School of Medicine.
Addictions and strong habits, they basically alter the chemistry and the connections of the reward system in the brain.
When you engage in a habit repeatedly, he explained, those connections get stronger and stronger.
You can't cut a formed connection, but you can create a new competing connection. But there will always be that old connection that was responsible for developing the bad habit.
That can be especially challenging when people overeat as a response to emotions, like stress, since those existing habits are so strongly developed in the brain. But, he says, new research techniques, which allow doctors to observe the brain in action, show that new connections can become strong enough to compete with old habits.
And they are showing that the brain is forming these new connections rather than changing the connections that were already existing based on when the person was developing the habit.
Kathy says she's had to work on lists of things she can do instead of eating as a reaction to stress or other emotions.
So then I also ask myself, what can I do instead of eating? So I can go work out, I can walk, I can drink some water. I like to go listen to music. I could go for a drive. I mean, there's just so many other things to do besides eat.
On top of that, Dr. Manick notes that the brain resists losing weight, and that resistance influences hormones that control hunger and fullness.
Like, there are hormones like insulin and leptin, which kind of goes, it changes with our weight loss, and that makes us much more hungrier. The levels of ghrelin go up, which makes us extremely hungry. So all the good hormones like leptin and insulin go down, and our bad hormones like ghrelin go up, and that makes us want to eat more.
That doesn't mean you should lose hope. Programs like the one Kathy took part in can help people gain the tools they need to change their habits in spite of the brain's resistance. For Kathy, that has meant training herself to challenge old habits and making her behavior match her new mindset.
How can I change my behavior to match my new way of thinking?
I'm Steph Whiteside.
The state of Illinois announced it will receive an additional $15 million in federal funds to expand addiction treatment services. Christine Herman has more on that.
The funding will pay for new treatment services in areas of Illinois hardest hit by addiction. The money will also fund existing programs like the Illinois Helpline for Opioids and Other Substances, which launched in 2017. Danny Kirby with Illinois Department of Human Services says the funding will support programs that provide medication-assisted treatment, which has been shown to increase a person's chance of recovery.
These programs include things like outreach in hospitals and jails, as well as street-based outreach that'll help us engage people who are experiencing opioid use disorders and help them connect with care.
Since 2016, Illinois has received $82 million from the U.S. government to address the opioid crisis. I'm Christine Herman.
And if you or someone you know is experiencing a substance abuse disorder, you can visit helplineil.org. Well, there are roughly 200 college in-prison programs nationwide, including here in Illinois. And there's a debate over whether they make a difference. The trouble is prisons measure the success of these initiatives by whether someone who's been released will return. But as Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines explains, one recent graduate says that's not a good way to measure success.
Johnny Page says he saw something as a child that no young person should ever see.
You know, I witnessed my cousin being killed when I was maybe 6-7 years old.
From that moment, he says he became a fighter. Page grew up in a low-income neighborhood in Chicago, and he joined a gang when he was about 11 years old. He started selling drugs, he was arrested, he was shot, and then his life took a turn for the worse.
And so a guy was killed. I got called responsible for it. I can tell you flat, I ain't had nothing to do with it.
The state of Illinois disagreed. At 18 years old, Page was sentenced to more than 2 decades in prison. That was in 1992. It wasn't until 2009 that Page heard about a new college in prison program, the Education Justice Project. It brings University of Illinois classes to the Danville Correctional Center in East Central Illinois. That's an all-male, medium-security prison with about 1,700 inmates. Page says he was skeptical, but he enrolled anyway because he had already exhausted the educational opportunities he had in prison.
Honestly, I just wanted as much information as I could possibly have, because I felt like I was sitting in cell because it was information I didn't have. It was some gaps.
Since 2009, more than 220 incarcerated people have taken U of I classes through the program. They can't earn a bachelor's degree, but students can transfer the credits they earn toward a degree once they're released. The program just celebrated its 10th anniversary, and now EJP is at an existential turning point.
We need a way to measure our success.
That's Rebecca Ginsburg. She directs EJP.
I'm saying that because many of the people who are saying we have a way to measure our success are, in my opinion, wrongheaded. And that way is typically through measuring recidivism of students who have completed the program.
EJP got a grant to figure out how to evaluate the program beyond recidivism rates. The program hired Nicole Robinson to do that. She routinely meets with incarcerated students and past participants, like Paige, to figure out what value they got out of EJP. Robinson says it's really hard to get prison staff and policymakers to care about measures that aren't recidivism.
What I anticipate to be hard and what already feels hard is that this work could be perceived as completely irrelevant.
The data isn't very reliable, but EJP says the recidivism rate for its students is only about 5%. And there's a study that found people who participate in prison education programs are less likely to return to prison. But that study from the RAND Corporation bothers Mary Gould.
It requires programs to say, here are our recidivism statistics, because it put in the minds of everyone in the public and policymakers and researchers and folks in the DOC that really the outcome is recidivism.
Gould is the interim director of the Alliance for Higher Education in Prison. That's a group that advocates for the expansion of higher ed in prisons nationwide.
So we're just leaving the vault and we're going to walk down to the visitor center.
I recently traveled with Gould to a prison in Bon Terre, Missouri. She directs a college in prison program there. The visitor's room is where everyone gathers for events.
It's a pretty stark, bright white environment, lots of lighting.
Inside, there's about 55 men in blue and gray prison uniforms sitting in rows. Everyone's here to talk about philosophy with professors from all around the country, including one from Harvard.
And so when we talk about the allegory and the cave, that's really synonymous with this prison system.
Gould says participating in an event like this isn't going to determine whether someone comes back to prison.
But is this part of that long and enduring process of gaining something that will eventually contribute to the health, the well-being, the success of the individual? Absolutely.
Ginsburg, like Gould, says recidivism data doesn't reveal much about what happens to people when they leave prison.
They don't capture people who are homeless. They don't capture people who have been estranged from their family. They don't capture people who are depressed or suicidal.
They don't capture people like Paige. I met up with Paige at his home in Blue Island. It's a red brick two flat in a suburb south of Chicago. And on this day, he's waiting for a fridge to be delivered. It's going up to the second floor.
Y'all out here doing a reality TV show?
Paige says he learned to research and to think critically while in EJP, and he created an anti-violence program with other students.
You equipped me with things that allowed me to go back into the community and be transformative.
Paige was released from prison in 2014. He works at a nonprofit that aims to stop violence by helping young people heal from traumatic experiences.
You can't measure how many people's lives I've saved. Because if my goal is to stop retaliatory violence, how do you measure that?
But that is what EJP is trying to measure. For 9 months, I repeatedly asked to sit in on meetings with students inside the Danville prison. The Illinois Department of Corrections denied my requests. I asked for an interview with an Illinois prison official. I wanted to know what prison staff thought about what the program was doing and what they saw as the value of EJP. The department denied that, too. Paige, the EJP alum, is concerned about the program's future.
I've worried about it from the day it started because I understood what it was. It's disruptive.
Paige says the program encourages students to think critically and to question everything. He says that's not what the prison system wants from its population. Paige says he's not worried about the guys in the program now.
But what about the guy that's getting off the bus right now, 19 years old, 10 years of doing prison, But he hears about this program called EJP, and it gives him something to aspire to. But I think the door should be open for him.
It's a lot of work to keep a college and prison program alive. And Paige, Ginsburg, and others say figuring out what that investment of time and money actually does for incarcerated students, beyond whether they return to prison, will hopefully ensure that programs like EJP continue to exist. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
That story produced with support from the Education Writers Association Reporting Fellowship Program. And we have more ahead here on Statewide. We'll get the latest on state efforts to deal with the teacher shortage. That's coming up. You're listening to Statewide. Just ahead, the teacher shortage and what some state leaders are considering. We'll get an update. And a reminder that our website is statewideshow.com. You can find links to the stories you hear each week and past episodes. Again, that's statewideshow.com. In 2017, then-Governor Bruce Rauner signed into law what was known as Charlie's Law. That required insurance companies to cover treatment costs for autoimmune diseases in children. One of those conditions is called PANDAS, and approximately 1 in 200 children suffer from it. PANDAS advocate Wendy Nawara sat down with Daisy Contreras to talk about how some insurance companies are still not covering treatment costs.
You have a personal story to go with this, so you have seen the symptoms and gone through the treatment process. Tell me more about that.
I have three children who have PANDAS or PANS, and one of them, Charlie, was one of the Charlies for whom the law was named in 2017. What happens when a child has pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorder associated with strep or pediatric acute onset neuropsychiatric syndrome is that they have an overnight onset of what looks to be mental health symptoms, and they are debilitating. Children might exhibit OCD in ways that they've never shown a propensity for. They might exhibit eating disorders. They're unable to sleep. They're unable to eat. They're afraid of water, going to school. They just exhibit quite a few symptoms, and oftentimes they become non-functional. So they can't attend school. They can't play with their friends. And parents are really scared half to death about what might have happened to their children. So, it was really important when we started this journey to ensure that families get insurance coverage for the treatment of this disorder, because if you do that, these children can go back to a normal, healthy life. My three children with PANDAS are currently all in college and doing quite well.
What's the difference between PANDAS and PANS?
PANS is kind of an umbrella term, the pediatric acute onset neuropsychiatric syndrome. It covers other infectious triggers like a pneumonia or Lyme disease, or even hand, foot, and mouth would be an infectious trigger. Whereas PANDAS, pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorder associated with strep, is strep-induced only. So PANDAS, think of PANDAS as being little, and PANS is a larger umbrella. And then autoimmune encephalopathies, which is the language that's in this legislation we're working on now, encompasses both of those things.
When it comes to the coding for insurance companies to cover PANDAS and PANS, walk me through that, the coding issue, and how the new language in this bill is going to clarify that.
Right. So the International Classification of Diseases is on its 10th version right now. And in the ICD-10, there is no specific code for PANDAS or PANS. But in the ICD-11, which is due to come out and be fully implemented by January 2022, PANDAS is included in that. So we really are asking for kind of a stopgap measure until that code can be implemented in doctor's offices across the state. We need our insurers to accept a code of autoimmune encephalopathy because it's the best code out there to describe what PANDAS and PANS are.
Tell me more about that treatment. costs could be up to $15,000.
So the treatments range from what would be, you know, considered a, for a mild case would be something like antibiotics, maybe steroids. And the treatment that has really caused roadblocks for our families is called IVIG, and that stands for intravenous immunoglobulin treatments. And what they do in that is they insert an IV and give a child immunoglobulins from many donors. What that tends to do is reset the immune system so that it works properly. It attacks the things it needs to attack as opposed to attacking a portion of the child's brain. Yes, it is extremely expensive. Like you said, up to $15,000. It's dosed based on the weight of the child. So honestly, the longer we wait to treat these kids, they grow bigger. Children grow. So the more expensive that treatment becomes. And if a doctor has inadvertently missed it, or if an insurance company puts roadblocks up in front of a family for a year at a time, you know, what could have been solved with perhaps a $5,000 treatment becomes that $15,000 treatment. So it's really important that, you know, we employ the new language to clarify Charlie's Law so that everyone knows what PANDAS and PANS are and what the treatment is, and they can get that covered.
That was Wendy Nawara, a PANDAS advocate, discussing some of the hurdles families still face when getting treatment for their children. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed a law in the past week intended to protect collective bargaining rights for labor unions. It would ban local governments from creating so-called right-to-work zones, where employees at a unionized company no longer have to pay fees if they choose not to join. Pritzker says it's another step toward ensuring working families can make a living wage.
From the start, right-to-work was an idea cooked up to lower wages, slash benefits, and hurt our working families. Right to work has always meant right to work for less money.
Former Governor Bruce Rauner was a promoter of local right to work zones. He vetoed similar legislation in 2017. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering whether the Village of Lincolnshire can enforce a right to work ordinance after local courts sided with the unions. Pritzker says the new law will settle the case. Illinois' General Assembly is on the first of a two-week break, and once lawmakers return to Springfield, they'll have a busy final month of their spring session. Key issues remain to be worked out, including adopting a state budget, negotiating a statewide infrastructure program, and possibly legalizing recreational marijuana and sports betting. That and more is on lawmakers' plates, and we'll continue to follow what's taking place right here on Statewide. State Board of Education this week hosted a conversation on possible solutions to the state's worsening teacher shortage. Our Dusty Rhodes was there, and she joins us now to fill us in on that conversation. And Dusty, you spent a morning at the State Board. They discussed changing the requirements for getting a teacher certificate in the state. Obviously a long discussion. What do we need to know about it?
Yeah, it was a really long discussion. It was, I would say, close to 3 hours, and in a very crowded room. There was a big turnout for this topic. So they started out by explaining all the different tests that teachers have to take. The first one is called basic skills, and until recently you had to take that before you could even become, you know, take junior level education courses. But it's been really problematic since around 2012. When they raised the cut scores. So at that time, they started accepting also certain high scores on the ACT or SAT. instead of the, you know, in lieu of the basic skills. But anyway, once you get past that hurdle, then there's two other big tests. One is called the EdTPA. It involves video. You have to video yourself as a student teacher, and that has a 97% pass rate. And then there's also specific content area tests.
Those are in addition to other coursework, of course, student teaching. So if they're talking about testing, does that mean they think testing is the cause of the teacher shortage?
Well, definitely not the only cause, but a huge part. You know, because like I said, that basic skills test for a long time prevented people from even coming into, you know, the upper level courses of teaching. So it just shut out a bunch of potential teachers. So there's legislation moving. There's mainly three bills that would each take away at least one of those tests. Two of those bills would eliminate the basic skills barrier completely, including the SAT and ACT cut scores. And one of those bills is sponsored by State Representative Sue Scherer. She's a former teacher. The other bill is sponsored by State Senator Andy Menar. He's also a former teacher, and he's considered a pretty powerful force in education policy. He's the guy that passed school funding reform.
So Illinois is going to get rid of a basic skills test. That doesn't sound good.
Yeah, no, it doesn't sound good. And I think sound is the key word. So, well, let's think about your iPhone. I had the first iPhone, and it let me talk and text and maybe take pictures. The iPhone I have now takes movies and navigates me down the road and tells me where cops are on the road. Not that I need that, but it would tell me where there's cops on the road. And it's still called an iPhone, right? So the basic skills test is like that. It's been in use since 1988, but it's been redesigned multiple times, and the cut scores have been increased. And yesterday, Jason Helfer was testifying. He's the ISBE administrator in charge of teaching and learning. And he made a point of choosing his words very carefully when he talked about the agency raising the cut scores, and he called that a questionable practice. So I should clarify, this is not a done deal. Right now, the only thing that's for sure going to happen is that the test called basic skills is going to be phased out by June 30th. But currently, teaching candidates will still have to achieve high scores on either the ACT or the SAT, unless one of those bills that I mentioned makes it into statute.
Now, does the State Board of Education support the legislation?
That depends on whether you're talking about the State Board as an agency or as board members themselves. So the agency has a staff that stays in place. The board members are appointed by the current governor's administration. So we have a new governor and we have a new board, almost totally. There's one holdover from the previous board. And this conversation has caught them a little off guard. You know, they got sworn in about 5 minutes ago, and they're really trying to make sure that they don't lower the standards. They each have a kind of regional perspective. They know what's happening where they are. But the agency staff, on the other hand, they've been struggling with this for more than a year. They've been going around doing listening tours. They've been visiting districts. They've been meeting different people, different superintendents who have really, you know, desperate needs for teachers. And so their conversation is more nuanced. That said, they are officially neutral on the basic skills testing legislation.
And what about people who want to do what's called alternative licensing, maybe second career people?
Well, that pipeline also got throttled over the past few years because at the same time that the state raised its cut scores, we also doubled the time required for alternative licensure. It used to be 1 year, now it's two. Changing it back to 1 year would take a change in statute, and I don't think anyone has filed a bill to do that yet. But there was a robust conversation about that, so I wouldn't be surprised to see it slipped into a shell bill, maybe.
You did a story earlier this year about paraprofessionals providing a possible solution to the teacher shortage. Did that come up this week?
It did. Two different superintendents testified yesterday about parapros that they have working in their schools, and they told these really poignant stories about how they want to teach, but they can't get past the barriers. One had failed the basic skills test, then tried to hit the mark on the ACT and failed that. The other one just can't afford to take unpaid time off to do student teaching. Actually, Senator Menard's bill would allow student teachers to be paid.
So, Dusty, one of the things that was not touched on was salary for teachers?
No, and Menard also has that bill, kind of infamous bill, that would make $40,000 a year the minimum salary for teachers. And that didn't really come up yesterday. Everybody kind of knows teachers need to be paid more.
All right, that is Dusty Rhodes. She's our education reporter. That wraps up another edition of Statewide. We're glad you could join us for reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. We'll have more next time. You can find this episode and past episodes at statewideshow.com. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations. Thank you.